Okay, yeah. Like Alan said, this is kind of a change gear at this point, from populations down to the individual cell level. And this was work that I did when I was a postdoc with Byron and Carla, and Micah was involved in the first thing. So I'm going to show two kind of different things, but in the same studying the same general area of immunology. We've heard a lot about T cells, so let me just refresh your memory about what T cells are doing. Cytotoxic T cells, which are the main focus of Rustam's talk, they kill cells which contain a virus which is reproducing, or certain kinds of intracellular bacteria. So what they can do is they go up to the cell and they scan the cell, see if it needs to be killed, and if it needs to be killed, they either tell it to kill itself, or they can just physically rupture the cell membrane. They can do all kinds of bad things to other cells. There are also, this is going to come up later in my talk, a different kind of T cell called a helper T cell. A helper T cell activates other parts of the immune system, B cells, which Alan was basically talking about yesterday morning, and macrophages, which we haven't heard much about, and I don't think we will, but they're another part of the immune system which can deal with certain kinds of bacteria. Clearly, it's important if you have this heavy machinery for killing things, you don't want it to be too hair-triggered, but on the other hand, you still want it to be sensitive. And you really want it to be specific. So cytotoxic T cells shouldn't be going around, they shouldn't be on too hair of a trigger, or they should be very careful at least about what they're going to kill, otherwise you're going to suffer an autoimmune, you're going to have an autoimmune disease where the immune system is out of control. And the same goes for inappropriate stimulation of B cells. So how do the T cells know what they're going to do? And so now I'm really looking down at the cell level. Well, here's some cell of the body, and suppose it's infected with a virus, which is this octagonal thing. The virus is reproducing, and it's trying to bud off new virus particles, which can go away and infect other cells. But as a side effect of this, there's a complicated machinery within almost every cell of your body, which takes anything within the cell membrane, chops it up, and presents it up on the surface, like this. So little pieces of this virus are being presented on the cell surface. Also on the cell surface are any other random chopped up proteins that the apparatus can get hold of. And when a T cell scans what's now called an antigen presenting cell, because it's presenting antigens on its surface, the T cells can scan these and detect whether or not these cells need to be killed or if any further action needs to be taken. Okay, don't really need that. Okay, so each T cell carries somewhere in the tens of thousands of identical T cell receptors. So for most of this talk, these are going to be these Y-shaped things. The antigen-presenting cell presents antigenic peptides on its surface in the jaws of this very interesting molecule called the MHC molecule. And there are different subclasses of MHC and different things. But for the purposes of this talk, the MHC is the presentation device. It's this yellow thing here, which is holding a peptide in its jaws. And this is the MHC, and here is a piece of peptide held and presented on the MHC for T cell surveillance. The T cell receptors, as we've heard in most detail in Alan's talk, there's the same principle of antibody formation applies basically to T cell receptors. And so they bind only well to a small class of the peptide MHC which are being presented. This is an incredibly sensitive thing. T cells can be, there are signs that the T cell can, a T cell can sense a, sorry, a T cell can produce at least a partial response from just a couple, two or three, of the right kind of peptides presented on the right kind of MHC. So it's extremely sensitive. That doesn't mean it would necessarily go all out and kill that cell. There is a gradation of response, and that's actually a very interesting thing. It's complicated. But you can see a calcium flux within a T cell based on just two or three of the correct kind of peptide MHC. And from an immune system design point of view, and this is also true, that this should be a pretty speedy kind of thing. The T cell can't hang around inspecting everything. There's a lot of cells to look at. So it should probably be trying to move through the there's cells where it doesn't recognize anything fairly quickly. And so that minute or less. Yeah, I know. Well, it depends, right? Depends who you ask. I'm aware that this is not. But I think order of a minute to several minutes is in that. What do you think, Miles?
Well, I was just thinking those video microscopy things where the T cells come up and sniff.
Well, it depends if the T cell is pre-activated and things, doesn't it?
I mean. Yeah, but I think big cells, basically, it was just being collagen matched up, and you've got it sitting there for 10 minutes. Yeah.
But. Right. Rob has claimed. You think it's. If you consider how few you know precursor cells there are, and they have to find the infection, it has to be a bit quicker than I think hours, surely.
But so this speed business. So if nothing's recognized, it's easier to move on. But you can spend longer if something seems to be recognized.
Yeah.
Check it's right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Where is all this happening?
Could be happening anywhere. In your body. I mean, anywhere that the lymphoid. I mean, anywhere these T cells can get to, this could be happening.
Yeah, but is it in
These cells can get into the organ. So, for instance, diabetes is a T cell. Type 2 diabetes is a T cell problem. The T cells can actually get into the spleen and mess around with the cells in the spleen, which are supposed to be producing insulin.
And in blood also, or in
predominantly.
So what roughly happens during an infection? There are cells. Typically called antigen, but there are cells that sort of wander around, and they can physically pick up a foreign object, eat them, phagocytic cells, and they tend to migrate into lymph nodes, spleen. Those are regions where, at any given time, a large fraction of lymphocytes reside, and maybe a third of the lymphocytes will be in lymph nodes and spleen, the residence there. But there's a high probability of encounter with cells that are specific for antigen there. And early events in immune response occur within these lymph nodes and spleen. These activation events occur, the cell populations start dividing, speaking. Your lymph nodes tend to swell of all of that. And after maybe 3 or 4 days of proliferation, there are large populations of cells now that are specific to the antigen. And then they start migrating out of the lymphoid tissues and surveying the local area and trying to find where there are other cells that are infected. Undergoing these effective functions. So the early events in lymphoid tissue and then the cells migrate out.
So that's one way they get around this timing problem, is you bring the antigens to the T cells as well as the other way around.
Yeah. How well are the the mechanics of this, or the underlying transport?
That's where I'm getting to. Oh, sorry, the mechanics of what?
Well, the whole process. And the how well is that understood? And where these time scales come from? Like, how do they know it should be minutes and not? Why doesn't it take 10^-3 seconds?
Well, I think
where does that,
that's going to come out from me and Nigel and Byron tomorrow. A bit. I mean, not completely. But, a bit.
But in terms of, for example, the 10 minutes and 20 minutes estimates are based on, not based on dendritic cells, which are the important cells that we think of in the presentation. So we really have no idea what it is for dendritic cells, and it could conceivably be much faster. Because there's only a few cells in the lymph node that are probably.
There's a fundamental limit that it can't be too much faster than this, because the characteristic unbinding time for a T cell, for a peptide MHC, which is recognized from a T cell receptor, is 10 seconds, 20 seconds, and it has to find the thing after it's touched it. So it can't be much less than this. On the other hand, it can't be much more than, so there's a trade off here, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. So although this isn't actually very important for the rest of my talk, I thought I'd present this now in preparation maybe for what comes later. So you have an antigen-presenting cell presenting antigens that the T cell receptors on a certain T cell recognize. So they come into close contact. And the question is, how does the T cell know that something is there? So this is the antigen-presenting cell with the with the MHC holding a peptide. And then here's the T cell receptor. And Byron's going to go into this in more detail, and I'm not qualified to go through this in huge detail. But there's no direct motion of the T cell receptor. At least it's no one's reported a big motion of the T cell receptor on binding of the peptide MHC. There's association of a second signaling molecule, so this is CD4, one example, with the peptide MHC, and there's some controversy over how this all works. And CD4, if you believe this model, brings LCK, which is a subsidiary signaling molecule, close to the T cell receptor. And then there's, I'm not going to get this right, but there's a sequence of phosphorylation events involving LCK, ZAP70, and LAT, and I think the end result is that phosphorylated ZAP70 is released here, and that acts as a signaling messenger, which can go down and trigger another, through a complicated chemical network, later responses of the T cell. That's 30 seconds of something you could spend several lifetimes working on, but that's the general idea. Okay. If you make dimers of peptide MHC, then they're able to cause partial activation of T cells just by making soluble dimers. So here's peptide MHC, the linker region. But it's unclear if you really require dimerization of peptide MHCs on the antigen-presenting cell for signaling, if that's really necessary for signaling. For soluble things, which doesn't occur in nature, single peptide MHCs don't do it. You need to dimerize. You need to cause aggregation of the T cell receptors to get signaling. And in fact, an experiment's been done where they changed the length of this linking region, and if the linking region was too long, you didn't see the signaling. The signaling dropped off with the length of the linker region. Okay. Oops. Okay. So these two cells have come into close proximity, like this. And some really beautiful experiments over the last sort of eight years have shown how molecules on the cell surface, which is all the T cell sees, are molecules on the surface of the antigen-presenting cell, and all the antigen-presenting cell sees is molecules on the surface of the T cell. These molecules, some of which are receptors and some of which aren't, are organized spatially, and I'm going to go into this in more detail. Really the point of my talk. But what happens is the cells, these two cells, just for this slide, they form a stable and compact region of contact where it seems like the T cell receptors and peptide MHC molecules can easily find each other and bind. And other important molecules can aggregate. And another thing that could happen is the certain molecules could be excluded, because if you have a big extracellular domain and the two cells come into a very close proximity, then this guy might be excluded. Unfortunately, that wasn't what was observed, but it was a nice idea. Okay, go back. Okay. So this region of contact between T cell and antigen-presenting cell is called the immunological synapse. It's also called other things. I'm going to call it the synapse. Within this region, you get certain important molecules for adhesion, so just for holding the cells together, and for signaling, have been observed in this series of experiments to be arranged in well-defined patterns. And in common with other people, I'm interested in how these patterns arise and their impact on the signaling and on the activation of the cell. Okay. So this is a movie from the lab of Mark Davis in Stanford. Okay, there we go. Let me tell you what, let's just look at the bottom frame first. This guy is an antigen-presenting cell, and an adhesion molecule called ICAM1 has been labeled with green fluorescent protein, and the T cells, which are these smaller cells, they carry a ligand for that intracellular adhesion molecule, ICAM, which is called LFA1, the ligand, which binds to it, and what you can see is the ICAM is concentrated at the close contact between the T cell receptor, between the T cell and the antigen-presenting cell, which is what you'd expect. Okay, these things can bind together, So they're going to be drawn into this region just by diffusion, if by nothing else. Okay. This upper frame, I'll run the movie one more time. This upper frame is showing calcium, is stain for calcium in the T cells, and so you can see that almost instantaneously after they bound to the antigen-presenting cell, calcium is released. So you get a very fast signal. I'm sure, by the way, that these antigen-presenting cells are carrying a lot of antigen that the T cell recognizes. So probably no question of sensitivity here. So if another guy's going to come along and stick here, and then he's going to go crazy. See that? No. Okay. This also shows that you can have many T cells stuck to one antigen-presenting cell.
So what's the time scale of moving?
It speeded up a bit. I think that's about 5 minutes or something like that. They've been loaded with peptide, but the peptide hadn't been labeled. They just labeled the intracellular adhesion molecule. Okay. All right. So this was really the experiment that sparked my interest in the immunological synapse. So what's been done here is this isn't actually quite right. There's a flat membrane here to which have been stuck ICAM-1 and peptide MHC. And the ICAM-1 is labeled in red, and the peptide MHC is labeled in green. And then the T cells float along, and they come down and stick to this flat membrane because they bear LFA-1, which sticks to ICAM, and they bear T cell receptors, which will stick to the peptide MHC. And this was what was observed. This is over the course of an hour. What happens initially is, well, this makes sense. The ICAM-1 are longer. So as the T cell comes in, the first things to touch are going to be the ICAMs, and they're going to tend to be in the center of the contact. So we're looking down on the contact here. This isn't a side view of the cell. If you imagine that this is the plane with the ICAM-1 and the peptide MHC, the cell is out here, and this is the contact region. And then what happens over the course of several minutes is there's a change from the short molecules being on the outside and the long molecules being on the inside to the opposite pattern. And then this pattern seems to be stable for quite a long time in this experiment. So this actually makes sense. Though the long molecules might touch first, if you imagine you had a basketball with long and short hairs and you brought it down, the long hairs would touch the thing first and they'd stick. But it would be more stable to have the long hairs arranged around the short hairs in the middle. And so this is what was argued in that paper, I think this was the commentary to the paper, that initially the T cell comes down, the long guys get to bind first, and some of the short guys will bind around the edge, but for thermodynamic reasons, the short guys end up in the middle with the long guys around the outside. But in fact, it's slightly more complicated than that, because this rearrangement is dependent on the cellular cytoskeleton, which is this network of actin filaments inside the cell. So if you put in a cytoskeleton, if you put in this chemical cytochelation, which screws up polymerization of the cytoskeleton, then you don't get this rearrangement, and the pattern sort of stays like this and maybe fluctuates a little bit. This final stage is stable for quite a long time, though. All right. This is a different kind of cell-cell synapse. This is what's called an NK cell. And NK cells, their job is to kill anything which doesn't have MHC. Because if you think about it, a virus that could evolve to downregulate MHC would never be detected by the immune system. So you have to have NK cells to kill anything which evades the T cells. Okay. Again, the red is the long bond and the green is the short bond. And at least for this experiment, this is from the lab of Dan Davis. Actually, it wasn't his lab at that time, but he has his own lab now, and he's doing these things. You see that the long bonds stay in the middle with the short bonds around the outside, and this persists. And this synapse is not inhibited by the addition of cytoskeletal inhibitors. Well, at least that's what they said, and talking to Nigel about this, it sounds like they backtracked a bit on that, and it's a bit unclear. But at any rate, the cytoskeleton might not be as important for this synapse formation process. Okay. All right. And just to indicate here, I want you all to learn these, and there'll be a test later, but there's a lot of molecules that could potentially be binding between a NK cell and a target cell. But you can see there is a separation of length scale between about 43, 45 nanometers for the ICAM1 LFA1 bond down to just 8 nanometers for this very short guy over here. Okay. So there's a large number of, and they could be separated by length. Okay. So people have modeled this. This is not the first model I'm going to show you for synapse. I'm going to show a model. I should have said this. I'm going to show a model for synapse formation in general between two cells which have long receptors and short receptors. Okay? And I'm going to make certain assumptions which are going to be very explicit. And the assumptions which I make will mean that my model won't apply to some kinds of synapses, but it might apply more to others. There have been previous models of synapse formation. The first model to be printed was from the group of Arup Chakraborty in Berkeley, and also a model by Nigel Burrows. So Christoph Wolfing's an experimentalist, so it's really Nigel's model. And both of these models are PDE models for the membrane position. So they write a PDE with elasticity terms for the membrane, for the position of the membrane of the cell above the supported bilayer holding the MHC molecule and the ICAM molecule. And they both have binding and unbinding of the long bonds and the short bonds. And they both include, at least in their final state, they both include active and energy expanding processes. So for instance, in Kia al, there's an explicit term for T cell receptor downregulation. And in a later version of the model, there was a term for receptor rearrangement by the cytoskeleton, which was also in Nigel's model originally. And both of these models were successful in finding synapses. The details of their conclusions were a bit different, but they both predicted a synapse, and they both got about the right time scales for the process that I showed you. Neither model, this is maybe a bit picky, but neither model really includes any part of the cell other than the part which is in the contact region. And so there are questions could arise, which you can deal with, regarding the boundary conditions for your model and how the surface tension is defined. And I don't think Arup or Nigel would disagree with me about that. Well, maybe you would, I don't know. Okay. So I just want to go back, and before I present our model for the system with long bonds and short bonds holding together two cells, I want to present a model came from Los Alamos in the 80s, which was George Bell and various collaborators. One paper was Micah Dembo and Pierre Bongrand. What they looked at was thermodynamic equilibrium of two cells bound by a single kind of ligand-receptor pair. So you have ligands on one cell, you have receptors on the other, and they stick together. Okay. And their strategy was to write down a change in a free energy due to the formation of this synapse. They didn't know to call it a synapse yet, that came later, as a function of some small number of variables. Okay. So the variables in their model were the number of bonds which had formed, the area of this contact region, so the area here, and the intercellular separation in the contact region, so the distance between the two cell membranes. Those were the three variables they had in their model. And they wrote down this change in free energy, which was equal to the number of bonds that had formed times the change in free energy per bond, essentially, which was a function of the number of bonds and the area they're confined to, because it includes entropic terms, and the cell-cell separation, S, which is, if you just have this term, then you would just predict that all the receptors and all the ligands would bind together in some region here. Actually, you wouldn't quite predict that because there is entropy in the model, but you'd be close to that. But what they added on was a intercellular repulsion. So the two cells didn't want to be close enough together. So this could be due to charge effects, or more likely, there's a network of long nebulous sugar molecules and things called the glycocalyx. And it's hard to compress that, so you have a natural repulsion between the cells. So that's area times this intercellular repulsion, this glycocalyx potential intercellular repulsion term. Yes.
So the glycocalyx doesn't diffuse away.
That's a very good question, and no, it doesn't. But later on in there, they did a second model which had freely mobile repelling things, It gets progressively more complicated. So this was their first
thing. What's the biology thing? If you have those nice pictures of the area and you label it like a tail?
Yeah.
Where does that go, for example?
No one's done that, as far as I know.
So same, like those nice pictures. Yeah, but you label it like a tail.
That's the nature of the bond. What is the nature of the bond?
I was just going to come to that. Okay, so each of these bonds is a Hookean spring. Okay, so basically what you have is you have the equilibrium constant for binding is equal to the equilibrium constant at the preferred separation, and then there's a term here which allows for the fact that you have to stretch, you have to deform the bond if the intercellular separation is not equal to the preferred length. Okay? So exactly what you said. So at equilibrium, you get that the density of bonds is equal to the density of receptors times the density of free ligands times this K of S, whatever S is. Okay. All right. So after parameterizing their model, these guys found phase transitions between bound and unbound states. So for instance, this phase diagram shows and what we're doing on the x-axis is increasing the number of ligands and receptors from 0 up to 10 to the 6. And here, n is the number of bonds, A is the area of the contact region, and S is the intercellular separation. So this is an inset panel. So as you start over here, as you increase the number of bonds, suddenly the cells go from being at infinity to being at some finite distance apart, and the number of bonds starts to increase, and the area of the contact region increases up to some level where you've got all the bonds you're going to have. Okay, so that was basically what their model did. That's very interesting. No one had done this kind of model before. Okay, so I'm going to come up with a very similar model to that, except it's going to have two kinds of ligands and receptors, which is going to introduce some extra complications, but not too many. To answer these questions, so just let me remind you, you've got the long bonds in the middle, and then you've got the long bonds on the outside. So because I'm going to write down a model which is equilibrium thermodynamics, I can't say anything about going from here to here. I can only really comment on what the final state is. So one thing I can ask is the final synapse pattern thermodynamically stable? And if it is, then the cell doesn't have to expend any energy, it just sits there. If it's not thermodynamically stable, there's some energy-consuming process to hold it there. So this is an interesting question to ask. Right? Because the cytoskeleton in this experiment is intrinsically a dynamic thing, that's not going to be in the model. Although it could be, but it'd have to be. You have to do it just right. T cell receptor downregulation and signaling are also not in this model because you can't change the number of T cell receptors that violate equilibrium. How will possible stable patterns vary over a range of parameters? So can we predict some experiments that we could map out a phase plane? This model finds a steady state in a second or so, whereas to run a PDE model from here to here takes several days. And do we agree with other theoretical predictions of the PDE models for end states? Okay, and this is all coming out hopefully soon. Okay, so what we're going to do is revise the Bell model so our change in free energy now allows for long and short bonds. So you're going to have some long bonds and some short bonds. Okay? But because you've got long and short bonds, now, accepting that there's enough stiffness to the cell membrane that you're going to have regions of long bonds and regions of short bonds, you're going to have to describe the boundary between the long bond-rich and the short bond-rich regions. Okay, so you need some description of that. And then for each region, you need a measure of how far apart the cells are in that region. So this is a direct extension of the Bell model. Okay, so just to go through this piece by piece, the ligand binding looks just the same as the Bell model. You have long bonds and short bonds, and they have different preferred lengths. So the change in free energy due to binding is a term for the long bonds and a term for the short bonds. They're treated as springs, just exactly like in the Bell model. So, for example, you get things that look like this, and these mu's are chemical potentials, and you integrate over the area where they're confined to, and blah blah blah. let me not go through that too much. Secondly, there's an intercellular repulsion term, which is identical to the term of Bell. So the change in energy is the integral over the area, and then times gamma of the separation over the area. The potential in Bell's case was purely repulsive, but when Nigel did his model, he had a potential well, so the cells wanted to be a certain distance apart. And like Rustam was alluding to, if you have an extracellular matrix, why don't they just diffuse out? Well, that could happen. So, you know, it's a good point. Okay. Bending and stretching. This is actually where the bulk of the work was, but I'm going to go through it just very quickly. If you have a long bond-rich region and a short bond-rich region, then you've got a deformation of the cell membrane between the long and the short regions. And Nigel helpfully computed the characteristic width of this region, and it's short compared to the size of the synapse. So you can treat this this interface as a line object if you just look at it, if you zoom out and look at it. So the change in free energy due to this elastic term is just some line tension times the sum of the lengths of all the lines. Okay, so that's that contribution to the thermodynamics. And I just realized there's one other term which I didn't put in, which is you can also calculate, given the shape of the cell here, which you can compute from the other parameters of the model, other variables of the model, you can figure out how the surface tension affects things. So there's actually a term for the surface tension, for the stretching out or squeezing in of the cell. Okay, now here comes the big assumption. Everything I did so far is quite general, but in order to get some clean results, and motivated by the experiments, we'll just assume that there are five possible configurations. The first configuration is the two cells are not bound together. The second configuration is that the cells are bound together, but entirely by short bonds, and all the long bonds are excluded. Second possibility is that you just have long bonds holding the two cells together, and there's no short bonds bound. And then there are possibilities where you have two different kinds of separation of the long bond and the short bond, motivated by the experimental data. And this makes sense too. If you're going to have a interface, then a circle is going to be the lowest energy for that interface. Modulo boundary effect. Okay. So if you do this, you end up with six variables. You have two radii for these two circles, and they could either of them could be zero. You have bond one, bond two. You have the separation here, and you have the separation here, or vice versa. Okay. There are quite a large number of parameters in this model. Some of them are known better than others. So let me get onto the results.
How were they determined?
What, each of them?
Well,
it depends.
Any of them.
Any of them. What do you mean? They're determined from experiment.
Attempt at determining from separate other
Yes, experiments. Absolutely. Yeah, there's no free parameter in the model. Yeah. There's no free parameter. I think that's your question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just look at. Sorry, Nigel. Yes, two-dimensional ideal gas assumption, okay. So let's look at what the antigen-presenting cell can do. It can modulate how many ICAMs it's showing, and it can modulate how many peptide MHCs it's showing. So by doing that, the antigen-presenting cell can actually, we already have quite a complicated phase pattern, phase diagram, but it can go by increasing the number of peptide MHCs from no binding to all short, or from no binding to all long. And the synapse patterns are actually in quite a narrow part of phase space up here. And actually, these are very high numbers of peptide MHCs. So perhaps we didn't parameterize the model quite right, or perhaps this is telling us something, that you really do need an energetic process to lead to a synapse pattern. T cells, on the other hand, can control the affinity of the LFA-ICAM1 interaction and spatial localization concentration of LFA1. So we can plot another phase diagram, the number of LFA1 available against the affinity, and the different numbers are presented. These are the numbers of peptide MHC, 2,000, 8,000, or 20,000. We can see that, you mean, this is, these are slices through the phase space, right? So you can see that you have this kind of from no to all long, or if you have just things just right, you can have a synapse or a reversed synapse. Reverse synapses with long on the inside, and the phase diagram moves around like this. They can change the conformation of LFA1. Yes.
So low numbers of IGANs or densities,
why do you get a low bond formation? Because there's a potential trying to push the cells apart. Yeah, there's a repulsive potential. Yeah, it's because if you want to have a lot of long bonds, and this is very simple. It's a little bit more complicated than this probably. If you want to have a lot of long bonds, they should be in the around the outside to minimize the length of the boundary containing them. So you have a choice. You can either put them in the middle or you can put them outside, and one way has a shorter boundary than the other way. Unless they're equal in numbers and other things being equal. That's the intuition. Yeah. Okay. So that's a problem. So the argument I just gave you is true if you ignore surface tension. But as soon as you put in surface tension, it's a bit different, like you said. Okay. And just looking at these are more phase planes in that previous sequence, we can look at the effect of increasing the surface tension from 0 up to 10 to the minus 7, and it changes the location of the phase boundaries. Sigma is that, and gamma is the this plot is an increased intercellular repulsion. Sorry, decreased intercellular repulsion. Is that right? No, it doesn't seem to be right either. Well, anyway, okay. Change the parameters, things move.
Patterns and boundaries,
you
get a difference
in the total
energy interaction between the two cells.
Yeah.
So which pattern corresponds to sort of the strongest?
Well, the most bonds of either kind. It's a question of the rearrangement. The rearrangement is sort of a small thing on the scale of that. You know? So you just want to have as many bonds formed as you can.
But they have different energy between the two cells.
Yeah. Yeah. The MHC is a weaker bond.
So in terms of the packing, the longer bond is not packing as well. I can see that. You know, in terms of the density that you can have those molecules, if you're a big molecule that's much longer, can you also have less per square nanometer? Or
I didn't think of that, and I don't know any reason why it would be true. But
bulkier.
Yeah, I mean, there's some sort of excluded volume, I suppose, if the thing is flopping around, but No, that's not in the model, but yeah, potentially. Okay, another thing is the synapse arguably shrinks over time. And this could be due to T-cell receptor downregulation. So if the T-cell receptors are being downregulated, you'd certainly expect the synapse to shrink. So if we say this is happening adiabatically, so the system equilibrates after each T-cell receptor has gone away, as the number of T-cell receptors decreases, the radius will also decrease. And this is plotted over cellular surface tensions, just to make the plot a bit more exciting. Okay. So one reason we did this was to compare with this phase plane, which came out of Arup Chakraborty's group. So this is the off rate of the T-cell receptor peptide MHC bond, and this is the on rate of the peptide MHC T-cell receptor bond. And so this is a phase diagram. And they find synapse formation in this tongue and in this tongue of phase space, but not in this funny gap in the middle, which is a funny thing, because if you look at our model, it only contains the affinity. So we don't have the level of detail of having K-on and K-off. We only have K-on divided by K-off. So all we can look at is straight lines through this phase space. So it's kind of a funny thing from the point of view of our model that you don't get a synapse formed in this gap, whereas you have one here, because the affinity of the interaction is the same along these straight lines. So that's an odd thing. The fact that that's the case indicates that it's due to some kind of non-equilibrium effect in their model, which is not particularly clear to me what it would be. It's probably due to the non-equilibrium effect. The other thing that makes our model different is we have the whole cell in the model explicitly. The only non-equilibrium effect in the model they used here is is receptor downregulation. But it's a funny thing that by downregulating receptors, you can cause this hole to appear in your phase diagram. I don't think they've given one. Certainly didn't give one in the paper. Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, they ran their PDE model at each of these blue dots. The green and red dots are experimental data. Okay.
Why is there no synapse when K off is low and go on?
K off is low?
Yeah, and why can't you go back and down?
That's another thing I don't understand, to be honest. Why? It might be that they're thinking of a synapse pattern as strictly being the short bonds in the middle, the long bonds around the outside, and we generalized that.
I think when you look at this, you have to be a little careful because they may have downregulation in the T cell receptor, and that depends strongly on K off. So.
They have a problem, right? Because eventually they're going to have no receptors on the surface, so they have to cut this off at some point and say, was there a synapse then? Do they? Okay. Probably to deal with that problem, actually. Right. Anyway, we can look at this. And so this band here where they find synapse formation is here. And we find that the TCR peptide MHC affinity has to be, according to theirs, it's kind of low. According to our model, this is the number of peptide MHC bound. We require a higher affinity, especially for low numbers of peptide MHC. Suggest their model might be forming a synapse we disagree on this. Okay, their model forms a synapse more easily than ours does. Okay, so what do we have? A simple tractable model to explore the parameters. A stable equilibrium. I think it's fair to say that everything I think the assumptions are very clear with this model. So it's very clear what we've assumed and what we haven't. So it forms a null hypothesis against which we can compare the results of the dynamic models. It's sensitive to parameters. Those phase planes have pretty tight phase boundaries, right? They're pretty close together. So a small change in the parameters can cause a phase transition. So the cell could have control over binding and unbinding and the type of synapse that it forms. Our model has a bit of a problem that if we have small densities of short bonds, these are the peptide MHCs, then we don't predict synapse formation where synapse formation has been observed or where the dynamic models, the model of Chakraborty really predicts it. So this indicates to us that there's some non-equilibrium effect, which means that the cell is actively expending energy to maintain its grip on the other cell. Stable equilibrium synapses depend only on affinities and not on kinetics, so that's my point about the graph I showed just before. And this is actually the first theoretical prediction of the reverse synapse, which I showed in the NK cell, where the long bonds are in the middle and the short bonds are around the outside, and this persists for a long time. And also I just mentioned that phanocytes, which are a juvenile T cell or something like this, I'm not really sure, they also have cytoskeletal independent synapses, so it might be interesting to apply a model to that system as well. Yeah?
I have two sort of general questions. Mm-hmm. One is, is there entropy here?
Yes.
Could you show that? It wasn't.
It's hidden away in the binding. So, I mean, this. Okay. I can explain it from here. Well, maybe I should do it from here. Okay. This is an affinity. The way you define the affinity includes the entropy. You define the affinity doesn't just include the free energy change in binding. Also includes the free energy change due to the fact that we're squeezing these. That these guys are getting more concentrated because affinities apply to that you multiply them times a concentration to get a concentration. So that's where the entropic terms are. What was the second question?
Well, when you refer to PDE models,
yes,
are they PDE models of a single
cell? Yes. Yes. The reason I didn't really go into more detail is because I think Nigel's going to talk, because he has this model, he's going to talk in more detail about it. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is still, in some sense, a mean field theory. I mean, you're assuming by putting this effective entropic term, it's still what we would call a mean field theory.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And the PDE models are also mean field theories in some sense?
That if you turn this into a PDE model in the most natural way, you would find a model very similar to the other PDE models. Okay, so what does that mean? If you put in diffusion of the two things, so you have, Nigel's going to explain this, but you have diffusion of these guys, you have diffusion of these guys, and you have binding and unbinding, and the binding constant, and the binding constant is a function of the separation here. So it's exactly the most natural thing you could do is what you would end up with. Yeah. What they end up with.
Because typically phase diagrams are only roughly given by theory. I mean, you don't take into account fluctuations.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, the Chakraborty's group looked at thymocytes, and they think fluctuations are important there.
One would expect.
Yeah, yeah. So, Jeffrey, do you have a question?
Well, it's a similar question, because I also was on entropy, but I had in mind more whether that may be a mythical thing that is there any sense in which the system is, or is there any constraint that optimizes this in some way? Is there any criterion for...
I don't really understand the question.
Well, let's put it slightly differently. I mean, there's a bunch of phenomena which depend on detailed dynamics. Are there any sort of universalities that are expressed in the way in which this dynamics takes place? I'm trying to get something more general. I mean,
minimizing the free energy.
I understand, but there's undermined, but presumably there's some dynamics that is going on in this. Some dynamic.
Well, you probably have a curve shortening equation for the interface, and you have mean curvature flow of the interface. Doesn't want to have corners. That would come up in Nigel's model this afternoon, I'm sure. So that would be a start. Plus chemical kinetics.
So you're asking why one would expect a thermodynamic approach to be.
He didn't address that.
Right? No, I didn't address that.
That's my original question. I guess what stimulated this was, again, going back to all these numbers that occur, all these dimension form numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And where in the hell do they come? You know, what is setting the scale of those?
Oh, so what? For instance, what are the important length scales and so forth in the model?
Where are they all coming from?
Okay, so
there must be one scale. You know, the room next door.
There's
a seminar going on. No doubt, trying to explain where everything comes from. The whole universe is one scale. So, you know, here's a very specific.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the length scale of the whole synapse is set by the size of the cell.
Exactly. That's metaphysical. But this is real stuff.
The length scale of the synapse is set by the size of the cell, and I think it's fair to say that some of the dynamic models, because they don't really consider the whole cell, they sort of missed that. And it's, you know, how many wavelengths of your pattern can you fit into the thing? Well, it doesn't matter because the cell is really a constraint. No one's looked at it. Okay, I was going to give a second part to my talk, but I only have 5 minutes left. But, I mean, so maybe I should take any questions you have up to this point, and then I'll just try to really rattle through the second part.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there evidence for PCR damage?
Yes, lots of it. Yeah.
Another very general question. It's two general questions. One, why do you think the cell, in the T-cell example, you know, changes the topology of the synapse?
the cell, is there any advantage?
Well, yeah, I'm going to get to that in just a minute. That'll be my next slide. But so okay. Ask me again.
And then the second question is, you know, when you're doing thermodynamics, of course, there is a stable frame of time. Now, clearly the cell, as we were saying, only wants to do this for a second, you know, a minute or something.
Right.
Or 2 minutes.
Right.
So in these models, how do the synapses break? And what's the that that's all the energy dependence and non-equilibrium?
I mean, it has to be non-equilibrium, right? If you've got a synapse formed, you have to do something to break it. But this is why it's very nice that the T cell receptor can control the affinity of the adhesion bond, and also it can control where they are on the cell surface. It can move them around to some extent. I'm not sure what the time scale for moving them around is. Yeah, it can up and down regulate things. But
if we're talking about trying to break things in, you know, minutes or 2 minutes,
one
of not feel compatible with that kind of time.
There isn't any data on breakdown synapses. There's nothing. Really not.
Yeah.
No,
one of the so the problem is, right, you're the experimentalist and you get a synapse, you're delighted, right? But you've put down so many peptide MHCs that you're in a completely unphysiological regime. I mean, the number of agonist peptide MHCs can be very small and you'll still get a synapse to form. So, you know, this model is in some way a model of the experiment, not of the in vivo situation.
If the model is good, then we can be able to move it into parameter regime that will tell us how you can be stable.
Yeah.
How you can, you know, go across the phase boundary and what that takes.
Yeah.
Massive changes in parameters.
Well, I mean, if you're at a boundary, it doesn't take much.
Right. Well, one of these, you know,
you change by 2%. But I have no idea.
Hey, Rustin has a question.
So this is a synapse which brings plenty of activity around.
Yeah.
What does the T cell do in the majority of encounters which it ignores?
Well, that's the same question. Yes. This is probably why why it's a non-equilibrium effect, because it has to get a signal to commit to making the synapse. Yeah.
Because the initial things are that adhesion molecules are fine, but those are useless.
Yeah, they don't do anything. Yeah.
Is the cytoskeleton required for PCR down regulation? In other words, when you block cytokinesis, you also block internalization and.
I don't know, Byron.
When you block new cytokinesis to block the microtubule assembly, you prevent pulling PCRs into the synapse, but you also prevent PCR downregulation because that requires plasma-converting tubes. So that could be one effect of cytokinesis in the block.
Could be. I don't know. Yeah, no, it could be a second effect. Yeah.
That's one of the effects, is not only to prevent aggregation, but prevent downregulation. So if that were important for synapse formation, then that would be part of that.
Yeah.
But that would be done experimentally to block downregulation for the molecule, the energy level.
Downregulation, I mean, there are experiments where downregulation happens extremely quickly as well. And you can lose the T cell receptors really, really fast. So perhaps the T cell receptors don't play a big role in the synapse, you know, because they're getting sucked off the cell surface so quickly. I mean, the long-term synapse. Okay, which brings me to my next point. All right. Sorry, no. From short in to short out,
right.
For instance. Oh, well, the simplest thing to do would be to increase the number of ICAMs. So this is an experiment that could be done. But it's quite hard. I asked Dan Davis about this with the NK cell, because I don't think there's much hope of this model working with the T cell, because I think the cytoskeleton is too strongly involved. With the NK cell, it seemed like it was possible. So I asked him, could you make cells with defined numbers of the long receptors on, and then in a defined way decrease that? And he didn't think he could. At least it would be hard. And he didn't want to do it either. Yeah. So this is one of the big problems, is knowing on a population level how many receptors are on a cell is one thing, but knowing how many the one that you're looking at has is, I think that's a really hard problem. Okay, so if synapses are not a thermodynamic consequence of cell-cell binding, then why the hell does this arrangement happen? You know, if the cell is really working to make this synapse, which in the T-cell case it seems to be, why does it care? Well, one thing, which is certainly part of it, I don't know why I have a question mark, is it focuses and organizes signaling molecules, or it seems to be. And that's a whole world, which I'm not going to talk about too much. I'm not sure about at all, really. It might come up. But another thing, which has been suggested in the popular press of immunology, is that it could be to target delivery of soluble signals to the specific cell. So remember, this T cell really wants to maybe kill this antigen-presenting cell or something. So we can look at, using a pretty simple model, whether this is true and how delivery of one molecule of a, say, a cytokine or a, you know, which is going to cause the cell to kill itself, can pass across the synapse region and how the synapse geometry might affect that. Okay, so for example, CD8 positive T cells secrete perforin, granzymes, and cytokines, all of which are nasty things, which lead to target cell death. So you'd really want those granzymes, perforin, and cytokines to all be focused onto this cell. You don't want them to be escaping and messing up other cells. Similarly, in order for B cells to be stimulated by T cells, IL-4 and IL-5 get transferred from the T cell to the helper T cell to the B cell. Okay, so you get bystander harm if you don't have well-directed secretion. Okay, so it's also been shown that granules, which are these things within the cell which hold cytokines, localize to the contact region between the cells before they're released. And actually, even the exact point of release has been measured in one paper, where it's within the outer ring of adhesion molecules, but just outside the synapse center part. So it's even almost a specific place they're being released at. Yeah, somewhere near there. Yeah, at least in that experiment. So van der Moer, who's quite a well-known immunologist at Oxford, he had a commentary in Science, and one thing he suggested was that the T cell organizes things like this so that, I mean, and this is actually quite wide. This is a cartoon, right? This is a wide thing. So that when the granules are released, they only have a short distance to travel to get to here, rather than potentially leaping out through this more porous, well, not more porous, but wider region here without making up to this cell surface here. So what would the difference? Well, they sort of release around here somewhere. I don't think he knew about that. Or if he did, I'm not sure if he included that in his argument. So his argument was that having the close synapse contact in the middle might be very important. That was his argument, which is something we can look at, right? Because we know how molecules diffuse. Look at that. Okay. So that inspired us to just do a very simple model. Okay, so this is the synapse region. So one cell is down here, and one cell is up here. And there's a source. And we didn't want to worry about where the source was. So there's a uniform source all the way along the bottom here, releasing molecules which are trying to make it to the top. Okay? So just by putting a reflecting boundary condition on the top membrane, we can work out what rate these molecules arrive at the upper surface. This is just a simple, you know, simply solve the steady diffusion equation. Okay? And the flux is equal to the total number of molecules times some function of D over A, where D over A is the aspect ratio of this squat cylinder. And so if D over A is zero, then all the molecules are making it, and it tapers off. So when D equals A, D of A equals one, you've got a cylinder which is basically a square shape, and only a small fraction of the molecules are making it to the top. And it makes no difference how thick the, makes a small difference, but it makes almost no difference whether you're held at 15 nanometers by T cell receptors, or if you're held at 43 nanometers by ICAMs. It doesn't make any difference. You lose almost none. And both of these fractions are underestimates anyway, because if the source is really here, not uniformly across the base, then you're going to be doing even better.
And what if the transport is not quite diffusion limited? There's some binding of the molecule.
You're just leading me onto my next slide every time. It's great. Okay. So let's make an application of this to something where we know some numbers. The soluble cytokine IL-4 is secreted from a helper T cell to helper B cell. And it binds to a cell surface receptor called IL-4R alpha. We calculate the release rate, which will essentially saturate the target receptors. So this requires that we essentially have the concentration at the top surface equal to Kd is half maximal binding. Okay, and Kd for this system is known to be 10 to minus 10 in mole units. So solving slightly different diffusion equation, slightly different boundary conditions, we can put in some estimate of the diffusion constant and figure out that a secretion rate of about between 20 and 60 molecules per second from the base, so these are uniformly distributed over the base, they're not all in one place being released, is sufficient to essentially saturate the top boundary. So that's actually an interesting result too, because armed with an estimate of how many molecules are in a granule, you could then say how many granules you have to release per second. I didn't do that yet. Okay. Now, what Narendra is asking about is what if you have a diffusion-limited reaction? So when the receptors are confined to a surface, the system is basically, it's not a well-mixed system, so transport is an issue. If the transport is slow compared to the ligand-receptor binding kinetics, then you know anything that arrives will get bound, but there's a competition among the receptors to get the ligand to get to them. And transport effects, we can deal with transport effects by introducing these diffusion-limited rate coefficients. Okay. So we call the secreted molecule C, concentration of receptors R. Oh, okay. Read L is L equals C, okay. And the bound complex is B. We have dB dt equals K forward. So K forward is an effective rate constant times receptor times ligand minus K reverse times B. So things come off, things go on. And then we have these effective rate coefficients, okay, which I'm not going to try to derive them, but if you look at the limit where K on is fast, so it's a fast reaction but it's slow diffusion, then K forward is approximately equal to K plus. On the other hand, if you have fast diffusion and a slow reaction, then K forward is approximately equal to K on. So you get the correct limits in both things, and this is dimensionally correct. So K plus here is the diffusion-limited rate constant, which is you get from solving the appropriate steady diffusion problem with the right boundary conditions with an absorbing boundary at the target in this case. Okay, so we can figure out what K plus is. It was great fun, Fourier-Bessel series. And we find what K plus is, and it's, oh, sorry about the units. Diffusion limitation, if you look at this thing, becomes important if this term becomes big. If this term is big, then you have a diffusion-limited reaction. So for these parameters, just putting in what we know the parameters are, this turns out to happen if R is bigger than about 10 to the 4 receptors per cell, and this intercellular separation doesn't make a big difference. The measured density on a B cell for that receptor is much smaller. It's only about 100 receptors per cell. So we can conclude in this case that the diffusion is not limiting the forward kinetics because there are just so few receptors that the ligands that get there are going to have trouble finding something to bind anyway. The rate at which they arrive doesn't matter. Okay, but on the other hand, we can look at the unbinding thing. So suppose you've released all the ligand from down here and then you've switched it off. There's no more ligand coming. And you have some things bound up on the top surface. And if this guy is released, he can diffuse around and he might rebind up here. Okay, so it's another diffusion-limited problem before he can escape out of the side here. And the binding kinetics are described in essentially the same way, except with a different diffusion-limited rate constant, because you have slightly different boundary conditions on the cylinder. So what we can do is we can estimate how many receptors there would be for this rebinding to be significant. And the probability of rebinding to the surface becomes significant if this term, which was the denominator, is again approximately equal to 1. Actually, I think there's a slash missing there. So using the parameters above for the B cell system, we find that the critical receptor number is R about equal to 30 for 15 nanometers, and R is about equal to 190 for 45 nanometers. So these are total numbers of receptors on the cell. So let me remind you that there's only about 100 receptors on the whole B cell, according to the measurement. So it does seem that the details of separation could become important for the unbinding problem. So this is sort of an efficiency, right? If this binding is triggering something, then you can get efficiency in two ways. You can either make sure everything gets there, or you can make sure that things that have got there, if they unbind, they bind onto another receptor. So this also has an implication for that even though these numbers are small, if they move to the contact region, that could have a big effect on the efficiency of signaling in this case. Okay, so the precise details of the geometry were not important in the transport. This is not really surprising if you actually think of one of these things. There's such a separation of scales that you're talking about, you know, a cylinder like this, if the synapse region is like this, you're talking the difference between that and that. So it's a small difference. So you don't, it's not really surprising that we get that result. But on the other hand, the confined space of the synapse can affect the duration or the efficiency you're getting by releasing a single ligand from the base of the cylindrical synapse region, because it can bounce around between the cell surface receptors, and it may take somewhat longer to escape if there's a small distance and a long distance. And finally, this is a really simple model. It took me about 2 days to do this. It took us a bit longer to think of it and 2 days to actually do it. But it's a model where we actually know exactly what the physics are, and we can be pretty confident about what I just said, which is a somewhat unusual. I mean, the previous model I said, I had to have caveats all over the shop, right? But this is a simple model which you could give to, you know, an undergraduate to do, but you can have a lot of confidence in it. So I think it's nice for that reason. And maybe we'll publish it sometime. Okay, now I'm done.